Welcome to the Greg Bennett Show. I'm your host, Greg Bennett, and this was a fascinating conversation with David Tilbury Davis, one of the legendary coaches in the world of triathlon, coaching some of the greatest that you've ever seen do the sport. And this conversation, you know, David is a very deep thinker. He's very conscious about the way he works with individual athletes. And I loved at one point when he described himself as a behavior change engineer or behavioral change engineer. And I just absolutely love that he's not looking at just the athlete to become a better professional athlete, but he's looking to say, hey, how can I help you with your life? And I thought that was really fantastic. We dive into what his crew have been up to, his athletes in 2023, what they got coming up and all of that. But we also discuss AI and wearables and how they can help coaches in the future, but how maybe, you know, it's not as inflated as we might think as well. So there's a lot in this one. I think you'll find this is just a great conversation with a really great human being. He stayed up very late to record this one, so I really appreciate him. A little bit of housekeeping. I want to thank everybody that's reached out to come onto the Fireside Friday chats. I've met so many remarkable people, honestly. Every single chat I've had has just been extraordinary. You, the listeners, are just doing incredible things. And it's just wonderful to hear from you. So please, if you're interested in having a chat, I just create a 30-minute, sometimes they go a bit longer, sort of time window on a Friday. For Aussies, that's often my Thursday afternoon, but I'll find a time for you. And it's just a chat. So if you're interested, let me know. I'd love to engage with all of you. So, please reach out. Also, if you're loving the show, you'd be doing me a huge favor if you'd share it with your family and friends. There's a lot of inspiration in these episodes with incredible people that I think you'd be doing your family and friends a really good thing by having them listen to these shows. And you're obviously doing good by the show. I want to keep growing this audience and the show. And finally, if you do love the show and you're on Apple, I'd love a review and perhaps a 5-star rating. Love to see those comments. Means the world to me. I am somebody that doesn't mind a little pat on the back every now and then. But feel free to reach out on Instagram DM if you want to chat. And I hope you enjoy this conversation with David as much as I did. And remember, success comes to those who endure just one moment longer. All right, today's guest is one of the greatest triathlon, mountain biking, and cycling coaches in the world. His ability to communicate and his deep well of knowledge have paved the way for athletes to clinch world titles, national championships, Olympic and Commonwealth Games qualifying, and an impressive collection of podium finishes all around the world. With over 2 decades of experience, he's guided talents like Lionel Sanders, Ashley Gentle, Matt Hansen, Sky Munch, Amalia Rose Watkinson, Cody Beals, Josh Amberger, and many, many others, helping them smash course records and dominate the world rankings. His analytical and deeply personalized coaching approach has turned promising athletes into champions. So, without further ado, welcome and thanks for joining me on The Greg Bennett Show, David Tilbury Davis. How are you, mate?
Not too bad. Absolute pleasure to be here, Greg. Thank you. I don't know what really to say after that introduction. I just feel like I'm some bloke that talks to people and helps them get the best out of themselves. So,
well, you've done that very, like, very well.
It's a little humbling. I listened to your interview with Dan Lerang, mm-hmm. who I guess I'd call an acquaintance and mm-hmm. enemy, if you could put it like that. Mm-hmm. And I suppose I'd describe myself as, you know those yellow and black books that you buy, like sort of, you know, Microsoft Word for dummies or Excel for dummies. So I'm basically like Dan Lerang for dummies. That's how you can best describe me.
And the episode's done. Okay, that's great.
Here we go.
I love it, mate. And look, between yourself and Dan Lerang and Dan Plews, you know, there's this core group of coaches that are really doing a phenomenal job. You've worked with, we'll get into it, but you've worked with, you know, age group and focus a lot on the professional athletes. But you really are pioneers in the direction of where coaching and training is going. You know, I just had Joe Friel on the show, and Joe has been coaching for since the 60s. And yeah. We were talking about the evolution of coaching, and it's really great for me to be able to have somebody like you to chat to as you evolve the way our great athletes of the world, you know, become better. And it's often not loads of scientific data. It's often the human element and the art side of it. And that's why I love having you on the show. I'm really grateful that, you know, where are you in the world? You're in Finland, and it's 9:15 at night.
Yep, I live in Helsinki in Finland. I, you know, I've lived around the world since I've been coaching full time. About 7 or 8 years in Spain, 3 in Texas, 3 in Seattle, and then settled in Helsinki with a wife and now family. So
wow. So it's the wife that got you to Helsinki?
Yeah, that's pretty much the story with every expat in Finland is, are you here because of a woman? Yes.
I'm in Florida for the same reason.
There you go. Yeah.
And you got 3 little ones.
Yep, I have 3 under 6. So oh, well, 5.5, 2.5 and 2 months. So.
Right. Well, I am amazed that you're still up, that you're still talking. You even said you've got another call after this episode that we're recording.
It's the joys of having athletes on multiple time zones. It would sometimes I ponder whether it would be nice to have, you know, a punch in at 9, punch out at 5, switch brain off job, but then I'd probably lose my mind. So yeah. I'm quite happy to be speaking to people in, you know, New Zealand 1 minute, Salt Lake City the next, and then, you know, UK and Sweden, you know, so it's good fun.
It is like that. I remember Laura and I, when we were both racing professional, sometimes you just, it'd be nice to just clock in and clock out and not have to have this 24/7 job. But I don't think we can do that. I don't think we're the kind of people that are employable like that, that we can clock in and clock out.
We're not wired that way.
No.
Yeah. I mean, I used to work in corporate for, you know, well over a decade. And I remember in one of my jobs, I managed a team. And there was an individual in my team who was very much like that, was brilliant in terms of, you know, what he did. He was absolutely brilliant at his job, you know, like just producing like the best quality work in the team. But absolutely, like, I'm a worker bee and that's all I want to be, and had no aspiration to be anything else, just wanted to be really good at what he did. And it's kind of almost ironic that on the one hand, I could never process that in my head, but then on the other hand, I now sit here with what I do and say, that's kind of who I am, actually, just with coaching and people. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's fascinating what we learn over, you know, I'm many decades of different jobs and meeting different people, working with different people, different cultures.
Get to know yourself, right? I mean, you get to know yourself through that. And what do you want? You know, who you are and what do you want? It's fun to explore. I think we're of similar age or region.
And, 52.
I'm 52 as well. There you go.
There we go.
So we're both old dads with young kids, because I've got a 6 and a 4-year-old.
Yeah,
so
I joke. My wife is about... that's a classic male, can't remember my wife's age. She's 13 years younger than me. And, you know, when you're young and you're like, yes, I want a wife that's younger than me, in a typical sort of misogynistic way. And then when you get old and you have kids when you're old, you're like, I truly, truly wish I was the same age as my wife.
Just the energy, right?
Yeah, I remember back to when I was that age and I was just chock full of energy.
Yeah, I get
anyway,
it.
Anyway. No,
I get it. We could do the whole episode on parenting in our 50s. Yeah. But yeah.
That's the great thing, isn't it? When you have young kids, if you, if you want to hone your coaching skills, you know, have several young children and hone your communication skill set. When there's no developed frontal cortex, you know, and then hone your communication skills.
Oh, that's brilliant. Maybe we've got to add that into all the coaching curriculum courses. Yeah, so, no. Until you've done your time parenting, you know, three kids under six, you really haven't learned how to communicate properly to athletes. I love it, mate. Well, look, it's February 29th. We're recording it on the leap day. Yeah.
So does that mean the next time you get me on is in 4 years' time?
4 years' time, mate. No way. One of my favorite things, if you know, on this show is to talk to the great coaches of the world. So I'm hoping this will be the first of many. But
look,
it's that time of year. Yep. You know, the early preseason races are almost upon us. Have you got many athletes lined up for events sort of in March here coming up?
Justin Metzler's racing Ironman New Zealand, Amelia's Watkinson's racing Ironman New Zealand, and then Sky Munch is racing the PTO race in Miami. Mm-hmm. And then we sort of start to get into sort of a few more races, a few more people racing. So
yeah.
That's the kickoff.
So. Yeah. Do you go to these events, or is it a bit hard for you to travel at the moment?
I try to be at some of them. I'll be in Singapore at the PTO event there. I've got probably, depending on wild cards, you know, I'll probably have a few people racing there, certainly Amelia and Ashley. Mm-hmm. So, I sort of plan to be at that one. And then depending on work, and travel and, you know, athlete demands, then I might be in the PTO race in London. But I also, I coach predominantly triathlon, but I have also in my time worked with, UFC fighters. And I coach a guy who's retired now. But I tend to do face-to-face work with him when he's working in Europe. So that clashes with PTO London. So if I'm at that, then I'll probably have to get up early and get on a fast train. Or I might not even be at those if another athlete sort of says, hey, I need you in this location to do some, you know, one-to-one training on the World Championships course. So we'll see.
Oh, UFC training. I left that off on the introduction, mate. are you the fitness side of it, or are you actually in the ring?
Fitness side of it. Yeah, just the sort of, you know, the athleticism side of it. It's a fascinating sport. You know, it's a rabbit hole of, you know, lactate dynamics and cognition and sort of, you know, being able to sort of concentrate under load. Wow. Under hypoxia. You know, I've researched free diving as an example in pursuit of understanding hypoxic, you know, work. So wow. It's fascinating.
Isn't that great that you can be in a role, you've been coaching for over two decades, and then keep expanding your knowledge and your curiosity, you know?
It's that C word. It's, you know, that I've always been curious. I'm all, you know, it's like one of the things I learned in corporate was I had a manager and he once said to me, he said, when you think you know it all, retire, because you don't. I was like, okay, noted.
Yeah. But that's the joy of work. I said this to somebody the other day, and I said, you want to find a job where the learning outweighs anything else. As soon as a job doesn't feel like you're learning anything anymore, even if the paycheck's good, honestly, what are you doing? That curiosity mindset is pretty important.
You know, globally we need, you know, worker bees, so to speak, and a lot of people can, you know, are very content doing those roles. But yeah, I think if you have a certain mindset, there's always an appetite for learning, and a dissatisfaction with what you know. You know, isn't there that great philosophical comment that, you know, you start at a certain point, I'm paraphrasing, but you sort of start at a certain point and then you learn lots and then you end up back at the same point, but with a different perspective. So
yes, I love that. Hey, mate, let's do this. I just want to look at your 2023 season and recap that. And then I want to go and get to know you a little bit more. But first off, let's look at last year, because it was quite a outstanding year for what we're calling the DTD crew. But mate, 35 podiums, of which 21 were wins. Tell me some of the highlights of 2023 for you as a coach and watching your athletes perform.
Yeah, I mean, sort of statistically, interestingly, it wasn't as good a year as the past. You know, typically my sort of strike rate with athletes is sort of 50% of the races end up being podiums, of which 50% end up being wins. So, you know, it was sort of mathematically a little bit lower last year. That's not a criticism of my athletes, or, you know, maybe it's a criticism of my coaching, but, you know, it's how the dice rolled. But it was good. I mean, I think if I had to highlight a couple of things, I'd probably say, sort of, you know, mid-season, I've been working with Jodie Robinson, who's a US female pro. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she'd been struggling for a couple of years. And, you know, we started working together. And then, you know, we were in a situation where we were going to go and do 70.3. And literally, like, a week before the race, it got cancelled. Actually, no, that's not right. No, we literally, like, the weekend of the race, it got cancelled because of wildfires. And then we just decided, let's just pivot. You have the fitness, you have the confidence. Let's just pivot into an Ironman the following weekend.
Wow.
And we went to Coeur d'Alene and she won it. So that was, was sort of mid-season. You know, there was obviously some wins along the way, but that was one thing that was really sort of satisfying from an outcome perspective. I guess the other was Ashley and Josh both winning the Asia Pacific Championships together. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. having that classic sort of couples champions podium. Mm-hmm. I wasn't the first to do it. That would be, you know, Casper Hendrickson with Clément Mignon and Mario Lampierre, long course worlds, but, you know, had to tick that box. So
great. Look, as a former couple, the wins that Laura and I had together were very few. We only had a couple of 70.3s, a couple, like, honestly, out of the hundreds of races we did, it was so few and far between that it is special. And I remember with Ash and Josh, I'd had them both just on the podcast a couple of weeks before that. And then to see them go and do it together made it even more special. So congrats on that one.
That was nice. And then Ashley's win in Singapore was it was nice to see as an outcome. You know, it had been a long season. It hadn't been a perfect season. And there was a lot of pressure, I guess. That I put on myself, not on Ashley, but that I put on myself to make sure that Ashley was going into that race, you know, as best prepared as she could be, knowing that she had the peace of mind that then as soon as she finished, she was sort of getting on a plane and going home to family, after having been away for a long time. So that was really special to see. And then, you know, at the back end of the season, you know, Sky Munch's performance in Florida, just really happy with that. You know, we knew going into Kona that Sky was in great shape. And, you know, the result in Kona was, I think we would both say was good, wasn't perfect. You know, there could have been some things, you know, one or two things a little different, but we took that fitness into Florida and then she, you know, put up a performance for the ages. It's the fastest time by any, you know, continental American female athlete ever. It was, if you just forget Roth, because everybody knows that course is short, it's sort of one of the top three or four bike splits of all time. So, you know, and it's, if you include Roth and, you know, Chrissy Wellington, Daniela Ryf, it's sort of eighth or ninth fastest bike time ever. That was just really pleasing to, you know, for her to see the fruition of her labors and her faith in what we've been doing. And, so that was a nice sort of finish to the year.
Yeah, Sky has been incredibly consistent for a number of years now, and that her seventh in Kona, that women's field at the Kona Ironman World Championships last year was really special. I mean, the times were close. It was, you know, she went at 8:43 with Chelsea just sort of 1 minute in front and Daniela Ryf in front of her, Taylor Nib. It was just with Annie Hug and Lucy Charles Barclay, of course, taking the wins, but it was so close. It was such great racing. She's right in the thick of it. And then to come on the back of that, to go do Ironman Florida, and let me just read out her splits because I got them in here in front of me. So 58-minute swim. She can probably find a few minutes there, which would be nice. A 4:23 bike. 4:23.
Yep.
And then a 2:54 marathon on the back of that for an 8:22 overall. Really, amazing performance. And then to backtrack a little bit, you know, you talk about Ashley Gentle and her year last year. In the last 2 years since she decided, I remember having her on the podcast when she was trying to decide, does she go for Paris Olympics or she should go long? And I remember having her after the show going, you've got to go long. Forget the Olympics. You've had your couple of goes at that. And since she's done that, it's basically been, she's hardly gone off the podium. And last year was really, I mean, winning Singapore, like you said, the PTO Asian Open, but still with seconds at the European and the US Opens. And then winning, having the Langkawi win at the end of the year. She won Noosa again for, was it 10 times? And
11, I think. 11 times. Yeah. I think they should just give her the ownership of the race.
Oh, my gosh. Like,
you just caretake ownership of this race for the next few
years. That's unbelievable. I mean, before her, it was Emma Snowsill, now Frodeno. She'd won it 6 or 7 times, and it was like this passing of the torch. And, Ash, she just doesn't seem to age either. I feel like I've known Ash and Josh for forever, and they're still right in the prime of their careers. I'm like, hang on, I was racing them back in 2012. What's going on here? But look, it's been outstanding, mate. Huge congrats.
Thank you.
It does feel very special to see your athletes perform the way they do. Do you find it's, you know, are you doing it all remote with all of your athletes? Do you ever have training camps? Are you able to do any in person?
So it's interesting. I do face-to-face work, trips to wind tunnels, trips to work with athletes at their home location or specific training environments, you know, not too often in the last couple of years because a combination of, you know, if you go back to pre-COVID, you know, I was definitely traveling to work with athletes, you know, multiple times a year. You know, during COVID, obviously no travel. And then after COVID, you know, a mixture of sort of having young kids,
of course,
not so much travel, but what's also interesting with the whole training camp thing is I think long course athletes are very different to short course athletes.
Yes.
I don't mean in any kind of weird way, but just it's, you're prepping for something fundamentally different. And for a long time I had this mindset that, you know, I've got to do the DTD crew training camp, but I've got to be a Pilates, you know, Club Polenta in Mallorca, you know, Tucson or whatever. I got to do this thing, get all my athletes there. And that was a big sort of gnawing in the back of my mind. And then I kind of thought, well, hang on a minute. Why don't I just ask my athletes what they want? And I asked all of my pro athletes and pretty much all of them said, not interested in the slightest. They all said, I like to be at home. You know, I effectively, you know, I like my own pillow. I like my own bed. I know where the fridge is. I know where the food is in the supermarket and what aisle it's on. And I know my bike routes. I know my run routes, you know, and I was like, I kind of get your point. So now I tend to kind of parachute in, you know, as needed. So for instance, last weekend I was in Stockholm, for a day, just doing some work with two Swedish professionals that I work with. And I popped over there previously earlier in the year simply because one of them also works with a guy called Anthony Lutola, who's just happens to be the swim coach of Sarah Sostrom. So it's nice to be able to sit down with someone like that and say, hey, you know, what do you think about, you know, this? And he was just, you know, just as curious about long distance triathlon and swimming for that, because in his mind and eye and brain is wired to sort of think about things in tenths of a second and, you know, how to get those tenths. And I'm sat there going, so we're trying to find a couple of minutes over something that takes 45 minutes. And he's just, you know, like, help me understand that. So it's just, it's really nice when you can sit down with coaches like that in different sports and just there's no ego. It's like, let's just share knowledge and all learn.
I love that. I one of the favorite things that I do on this show is just have conversations with like-minded people that are all trying to, whether we're talking mental performance or trying to find marginal gains in the physical, you know, I spent a career trying to do it, and I still love on the back end now of having these discussions. What I'd like to do is get to know you a little bit better before we go too far, and then we'll dive into your coaching philosophies and how you operate a little bit after. But for the moment, what I like to do is rewind the clock and just tell me how you sort of came into the world of, you know, finding your passion for triathlon coaching. So if you can give us a bit of a framework, that'd be great.
I'm glad you finished that sentence and said, you know, how did you come into the world?
give me all the details. Here we go.
So I was named after a horse because my mother was just watching the TV in the hospital. I studied at Loughborough University, which is a centre of excellence for sport in the UK. It's one of those places where if you're playing on the rugby team for the university, you're probably playing for either England, Ireland, Scotland or Wales.
Wow.
I was there at the same time as Paula Radcliffe, as an example. That's the calibre of... Steve Back and Mick Hill were there throwing spears on the athletics track as well at the same time. So it was back in early 90s, mid 90s. And so whilst I was there, I've always been into lots of different sports as I grew up. And I was playing multiple sports when I was at university. And I just sort of started playing American football, ended up playing for Great Britain. And then... nearly had my knee completely blown out. For the American listeners, this will make sense, but I used to play running back. And back in the day when I had no neck and was about 10 kilos of muscle heavier, but, I was playing running back and I took a pitch to the right and the cornerback was on a blitz and the linebacker was on a blitz and the cornerback hit me in the shoulder and the linebacker hit me on the inside knee. And so my knee got bent, nothing broke, but at that point I decided, maybe a sport that goes in a straight line might be more fun to do. So I started doing my postgraduate research in biomechanics. I basically did a bunch of research for the Ministry of Defence in load carriage. So I was doing a lot of gait analysis and rucksacks and talking with people in special forces and stuff like that. And I just loved cycling. So I joined the triathlon club and really enjoyed it. I'd learned to swim as a kid, but I wasn't really great. So I think I can't even remember, but I was probably doing short course yard hundreds on maybe like 150 when I started. Yeah. But my lane one was led by Richard Stannard. My lane two was led by Jessica Harrison. There's a bunch of people in there that you used to race against. Yeah. And so I very much immersed myself in the sport because I'm just, I'm curious by nature and fascinated by detail. So within a year or two, I started sort of just coaching because British Triathlon didn't even exist at Loughborough University then. So it was just a university squad. So I just started sort of coaching the swimming and I'd have chats with the swim coach who, you know, happened to be the GB swim coach. He's a guy called Ian Armiger. And that's just really sort of where it started. And then I sort of got my coaching qualifications and then just sort of started helping a few, you know, friends out. And then when I finished university and my research, I completely changed tack and went into financial services, but I ended up in Leeds. So then I joined the club there and was working alongside Jack Maitland. So I got to have, you know, some influence and guidance from Jack and the other coaches there, Simon Ward, and coaching with the club, working with athletes face to face, and then helping, you know, age group individuals from, you know, national level juniors to 65-year-old age groupers and everything in between. And that just, you know, over the years, I continued to do that, you know, helping, you know, a few individuals out. And then eventually sort of 2008, 2009, I had the opportunity to leave financial services, just as the sort of, you know, dot-com bubble burst. It wasn't my fault. The bank wasn't able to lend any more money, and that was not my fault. So.
Don't blame it all on me. It wasn't just David's fault.
And I just decided to kind of make coaching a full-time thing. So then I moved over to Spain and just sort of went from there. And I never really have marketed myself. It's always been a referral thing, or people have sort of got to hear about me. So I don't run a coaching business. It's just me, myself, and I don't sell training plans. It's just, you know, I work with a handful of people globally, and I made that bed, and I've always been happy lying in it. So.
Well, you know, what was fascinating about that is going through the history of British triathlon, and, you know, from Loughborough University, where I can't tell you how many times I've heard Loughborough University doing this podcast, you know, with all the great, you know, British triathletes have all either been through there or mentioned it to some point. And then of course Leeds, and for people who don't know who Jack Maitland is, he's the Alistair and Jonathan Brownlee's coach. And so you would have been there at the time where you would have seen a couple of young kids maybe poking their heads around, considering the sport.
I don't think I ever crossed paths with Alistair and Johnny when I was coaching in Leeds, but I kind of heard of them because they were training as juniors with Jack's tutelage. I mean, the funny thing is actually a couple of weeks ago, I was having a chat with Jodie Swallow, or Kunama, as she's known now, about coaching stuff, and we were just sort of shooting the breeze. And I said, the funny thing is, Jody, I said, when you started triathlon, one of the first bike rides that you ever went out on, you know, I was still at Loughborough and I was on that ride. And I remember you, I wasn't picking on her, but I said, I remember you falling off your bike at the traffic lights. And we were having a laugh about it. She said, you know, she said in the usual fashion, she said, it doesn't seem that long ago that it was a long time ago. And it's like, yes.
Jodie's a fascinating, it was really great to have Jodie on the show. She was very honest and really, you know, she's one of the great all-time juniors in sport, you know, really dominated. And the transition to professionals, that was pretty tough for her because she hadn't learned to lose terribly much as a youngster. And it was a really great episode because it was kind of enlightening at the importance of maybe having some losses. You know, it's where you get to learn the difficult times. She said, look, I worked very hard as a kid, but, you know, I had some talent and didn't lose a lot. And so when she got to the pros, it was really hard for her to take. Fantastic episode. And I love Jodie and James, great couple. But yeah, that was one of the really special episodes that I've recorded. But look, what are some of the, you know, you've stepped out of financial services, moved into sort of working for yourself, which becomes this entrepreneurial type journey, right? Yeah. Were there some challenges along the way that you had to sort of getting enough athletes or finding the right training that worked for people? How's that sort of been?
I mean, I've been coaching nearly 30 years now. So it's over the years, there's been an ebb and flow in the number of athletes that I've coached. I've always tried to limit myself to about 16 athletes globally. In the early days, maybe it wasn't that much, but I was living in Spain and cost of living wasn't high. So it wasn't, you know, a concern. You know, I'd done the whole fast car, fast living thing in financial services. My first job in financial services, this will make you laugh, was a bit like Boiler Room. It's like, if you want to eat, there's the phone book, go sell. And it was like, okay, right, that's just wasn't quite clear in the job description, but you give me the job now, so I'll just get on with it. You know, it was a very, very testosterone-fueled environment, and that includes the females in the office that were sales staff as well. So
yeah.
It was fun times, but yeah, I'd moved on from that sort of perspective in life and was just sort of happy helping people, and it very much became something that happened just sort of organically. Corin Abraham got in touch, and I ended up working with Corin for many years. Prior to that, I worked with Aisha Rollinson, who had raced ITU, mm-hmm. and then moved over to Long Course. And then I coached a couple of age groupers in Brazil. So I spent 5 weeks in Brazil at one point. I just sort of kept rowing the boat, so to speak, and went wherever it took me. And over time, it sort of took me to a point where I felt, okay, I need to go and base myself in the US. And so I moved over to the US for some years and then sort of got to a point where I was like, well, it doesn't really matter where I am. And, you know, we're having a family now, and mm-hmm. Finland has social healthcare. So let's very quickly do some maths on that. And that's not a difficult decision. So that's where I sort of ended up, where I am.
And you transitioned from, you were doing some amateur age group athletes. You're working now, all your whole squad that you're working with, they're all professionals?
Yes. Yeah.
Is that right?
That's just sort of happened organically.
Well, the age groupers you were coaching became professional, but they became too good?
Not so much. I'm trying to think of the last person. I've had one young lady in the US that I coached as an age grouper a couple of years ago, and she's now transitioned to professional.
Yeah.
Adele Lykin. She used to, interestingly, she's fascinating. She rode at University of Washington, and the crew that she rode in broke the national record at the national championships, for a record that stood for like decades. And half that boat's now rowing for sort of USA or Germany or somewhere. So
isn't University of Washington where the Boys in the Boat book is
exactly
all about?
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Great book, by the way, everybody.
Indeed. Indeed. Yeah,
the movie just came out too. I haven't seen the movie yet. But
That's a good read.
Sorry, mate. I'm jumping all over the place,
but it was a good book. Right.
Yeah. So tell me, you know, you've done your courses in coaching, but, mm-hmm. you know, as an athlete, I went through and you know, was coaching myself and Laura for many years and a couple of other people's. And you become influenced by certain coaching philosophies or the ways that you like to do things or approach things. Would you be able to sort of share what you think your core coaching philosophy is, and even add to that, you know, potentially some of your mentors or influences in the coaching space?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the first thing I'd say on that is you have to be, coaching philosophy is sort of a bit of a hot topic in the last few years. And I think you have to be really careful with what you actually mean by that, because it's very easy for a lot of coaches, even myself, to talk ideology even rhetoric. But really, what coaching philosophy is espoused in the actions that I'm taking on a day-to-day basis. So what am I actually doing with my athletes, as opposed to some sort of, you know, ideological principle? And really, I would say that, you know, from the very get-go, like I said, I've always been curious. So the basis of what I do is very knowledge-driven, or, you know, epistemologically driven. But that's bounded by sort of sound principles of reasoning, you know, logic and first principles of physiology, neurology, psychology. I don't really do anything based on intuition, or faith, or like, oh, I did this with this athlete, so I'm just going to do it with everybody. I probably suffer from a level of anxiety or imposter syndrome that sort of centers around always being cognizant of any cognitive biases that I might have. So I don't have a certain dogma. You know, there are certain coaches that are like, this is how I do things. Mm-hmm. This is what I feel works. And, you know, if you're a square peg and you don't fit in the round hole, you're not my problem. I coach individuals. I've always coached the individual in front of me.
Love that.
And really, if you said, you know, what's my coaching philosophy, I'd say, I just treat people the way that I'd want to be treated. Full stop. Now, the fact that I would want to be treated with a level of curiosity and engagement and listening and detail and understanding and empathy that is beyond what most people experience in coaching, you know, that's probably then reflected in how I behave and treat athletes.
You know what? You've got me thinking about, I was talking to a guy actually just at the gym this morning. And side note, I put on about 30 pounds since race weight.
That's called dad bod.
I'd like to say it's a lot of muscle. It's not all, there is a dad bod component. I'm not going to lie.
It's funny, you look at sociological research and it actually says that when they've done research with ladies around what they're looking for in a partner, the evidence is clear that, you know, those people with a dad bod are preferred versus your super chiseled, you know, gym monkey, because they see that person as a potential, you know, a potential threat, potential narcissistic qualities, whereas the dad bod person obviously has the capacity to provide because, you know, he's able to eat. So I was like, I really like that research. I'm going to repeat that regularly.
So. Oh, I love it. I heard something very similar, and it was if you see a dad and he's totally ripped and he's got young kids, he's not actually being around. He's spending more time at the gym and, to your point, being a narcissist and not helping out as much. And but where was I going?
I mean, I think we've got on that point, though. I mean, I think that's a really interesting point because, in the context of coaching in this day and age, you know, we're constantly battling, you know, sort of influencers, you know, out there that, and funnily enough, I did a talk to the undergraduate students at University of Iowa when I was working with Matt Hansen, and he was a sports science professor, and I was up doing some work with him, and he said, "Hey, can you come and talk to the students?" And one of the students asked me a question at the end of the lecture. And said, you know, do you have any advice on, you know, what I should do? And I said, yeah, continue to major in sports science, but minor in social media and marketing. So because if you can't do that in this day and age, you're going to struggle. And I think those types of individuals, I always have a chuckle when I see the sort of the 4 a.m. brigade saying, oh, I've been doing this. And I'm like, okay, but how much housework have you been doing? How much childcare have you been doing? How much cooking have you been doing? How much cleaning have you been doing? Because who I'd like to interview is your wife, you know?
Yes, well, I think...
And understand, you know, how they prop you up.
Absolutely.
And that's fine, you know, that people make those choices, but it's just like, let's not sugarcoat it.
I've said this to Laura so many times where it's like, we're all listening to whether it's Huberman or Tim Ferriss or whatever. And I'm like, well, hang on. Until you have putting somebody else before your life, like it's not about you. Like once you become a dad, it's like, it's you're providing and protecting for the two little people that, or for, in your case, three, they can't do anything without you. And you need to be stepping up the game, and it changes your whole perspective of life. In this sense of, it's not about me, or even when it was just Laura and I, which was, you know, even then I was thinking about her a lot, but it's with kids, it changes everything.
That's Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. That's, happiness is found in putting others first. You know?
100%. Isn't that the truth? You know, it's like this, you want to get yourself out of the downward spiral of depression. And I often say, it doesn't have to be a lot, you know, to put somebody else first can be just when you walk into the supermarket, be the first to say good morning to somebody, right?
Yeah.
Start simple is my point with the whole mindset of, you know, do good to others. And it's amazing how good it makes you feel. The reward in itself is unbelievably selfish if you think about it, because it feels so good. So I always make my kids be there. You know, when you go to school, you got to be the first to say hello. You never know what that kid's going through. Make sure you stay in the moment and make sure you say hello to them first. And but you've mentioned a couple of really good things I want to go back and touch on. One was looking at the athletes as individuals. And I was talking to a guy at the gym this morning And he's a built like a strong, strong lad. Lovely guy, but built like a
brick outhouse, as we say.
Yeah. And I said, mate, if you look at, I like going back to ancestral health to figure out all things. And we can't do it as well because we have so many environmental changes in our life from air conditioning and everything else. But I said, look at you. I said, look, you're the one that's going to be holding the spear and stabbing the woolly mammoth from underneath. I said, and that little guy over there, super ripped, fit guy, I said, we're going to slingshot him onto the, or catapult him onto the back of the woolly mammoth, and he's going to be stabbing him from the top. I said, me, I'm strong enough now that I'm going to carry the meat back to the village as fast as possible on my shoulders, but I've got the endurance and strength. So I said, the way that we need to train ourselves and the type of bodies that we are and what we're trying to achieve is going to be very, very different. Now, you happen to be working with a whole bunch of triathletes, but the point is looking at the individual, where they came from and how they operate matters in the type of training and the way they prepare for a race, you know?
It does. There's for the life of me, the coach's name slips my mind, but I was chatting with somebody about, you know, this topic of understanding your athlete, and this coach made the point that you want to understand an athlete's core values, not their values as an athlete, because that's different. You know, you want to understand a person's core values, because that will influence how they respond to certain training stimuli, how they race, how they respond to certain scenarios, what's important to them, what's not important to them. You know, and as a coach, you know, understanding the athletes, I'm 52, I'm white, I speak English, I can get by in Spanish, but I coach athletes from a multitude of cultures, some of them who don't have English as a first language. So what I'm also cognizant of is, you know, how do I bridge the gender gap? How do I bridge the age gap? How do I bridge the culture gap? How do I bridge the language gap? Because all of those things, from a communication, whether it's face-to-face or over the phone or over, you know, over video call, those are all barriers to me being able to walk in that person's shoes, for want of a phrase. And I really prefer that phrase when people talk about it, described as, in essence, getting the athlete to understand that they need to help you understand what it is like to walk in their shoes. It's not my job to try and figure out what it's like to walk in their shoes. They need to help me understand it through, you know, communication. And I think communication and, you know, sort of pedagogy or different styles of teaching, you know, heutagogy and andragogy, those things, they're different styles for different individuals. But I think communication is so paramount. You know, X's and O's, if you want to talk team sports, you know, those are great. But communication is king in my book, or buy-in, I think is a better way of putting it. I think buy-in, and that covers a multitude of facets, you know, in relation to what, you know, we might talk about. But yeah, there we go.
I think you're nailing it, because I think Laura and I always laugh because the way the two of us are motivated completely differently. I'm motivated by the pats on the back. It's like, Greg, you're swimming really great, mate. You're holding great form. What would be great is if you could get that right hand just to, it's slipping a little bit, mate, and you're missing a little bit of water on the front end, right? That's how I'm going to improve my swimming, with a nice wrapped bit of, you know, Greg, you're doing things great. Here's a tiny little bit of a tip. Laura doesn't want to hear the praise. She wants to be, look, Laura, you can swim faster by just adjusting your hand and getting more. Like she can take, I don't take well to somebody just telling me what to do. I need the little bit of a, I'm doing things all right. And I think the more you can understand an athlete's mindset and the way that they like to be told, and that takes time, you know.
Ultimately, when I worked in financial services, one of my managers said to me, you know, I got a reputation for being, you know, somebody that you could say, you know, pull out the Financial Times and point an investment fund and say, you know, what's the risk profile of that fund, and the what's their portfolio exposure like globally, and I could give you sort of a sense of that. And he said, don't forget, people buy people. They don't buy knowledge. Now, the knowledge is great. You know, that's that's good to have in your back pocket or in the back of your head, but people buy people. And it's the same in coaching. Mm-hmm. You know, buy-in is king. I need to, and it's not in any Machiavellian way, but it's you know, when I'm working with Ashley or Josh or Sky or Rasmus Svenningsen or, you know, Andrew Horsfall Turner, they're all different cultures. Mm-hmm. Different backgrounds, different educations. You know, I've coached athletes that are highly, highly educated, and I've coached athletes that haven't gone to university. Mm-hmm. And you need to be able to understand them mm-hmm. More than ever in this day and age. And I think, you know, Cody Beals once described me as a sort of Renaissance coach. And I think, That's probably a good way of putting it, because I never feel that I'm the smartest person in the room, but I am super confident that in myself, that if I don't understand something, I'm happy to say, hey, look, I don't understand this. You know, a company might have a particular way of doing something that's meant to add value to an athlete. And I say, look, I don't understand this. Help me understand it in simple terms.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's this sort of constant pursuit of understanding is what's allowed me to get to where I am today.
Mm-hmm. Are you finding that athletes are coming to you, and then are you having to turn some away? Are you asking them questions, you know, like, why are you wanting to do this? You know, what's their why is often a good place to start with somebody, but how are you kind of deciding who to work with and who not to work with?
Yeah, I definitely have a screening process. I've spoken to athlete, you know, to many athletes over the years that I haven't ended up working with. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I only coach about sort of 15, 16 people globally. So ultimately it's a bit like a ferry and a roll on, roll off approach, you know, mm-hmm. until somebody retires or goes and has a kid, mm-hmm. I don't have more capacity. So, yeah. I probably get an inquiry a week.
Wow. That's a lot to sift through.
And I just sort of, you know, I just write back to him and said, look, I'm really sorry, but I'm not in a position to help you. And I actually have a little bit of a waiting list of pros that are interested.
Yeah. But what about if you got an email from somebody called Greg Bennett who wanted to make a comeback at 52? No, I'm just kidding.
Mate, yeah. I'd say you're old and broken, mate. Take the wins. Take the wins and don't embrace any more losses.
And you just nailed it. And I'm more than aware of that.
I also have a reputation for being a no bullshit sort of.
Yes, honesty, please. Please. I like that. I like that. And actually, for me, a coach needs to be fully trustworthy, honest, call it how it is. Wrap it in cotton wool for me a little bit. You can be more straight up with Laura. But no, that's fantastic, mate. Look, I want to jump forward a little bit and just talk about sort of the sport of triathlon as a whole and get your views on sort of even things when we talk about technology these days coming in.
Yeah.
I'm spending a lot of time in the tech space. I've just built one company, which we just got acquired by Whoop, and now leaning in to build another AI company. Would love to get your thoughts on how you think technology and wearables and potentially AI could help you as a coach. And if you think they're a good thing.
It depends, I think, is the answer. You know, there's always context with these things. I think any coach that isn't at least trying to understand AI is more than likely in 5 to 10 years going to lose their job to a human. That's important, to a human that uses AI.
Yes.
Not to the AI, but to the human that uses AI. Because, you know, ultimately, if you look at AI currently, it is ultimately just pattern recognition. It's not sentient. Yes. So I mm-hmm. think that's a concern that maybe people have, is like, oh, AI is sentient. No, mm-hmm. it's not. We're not in some sci-fi fiction movie.
Yeah, yet.
yet. but also as well is that, you know, all AI has to be trained. Mm-hmm. It has to be trained on a data set. So there is a reason that there are many companies that have produced certain products that then that product has died a death because they can't breach GDPR regulations globally. And what I mean by that is that, as an example, if you decide that you're going to develop a piece of software within a coaching platform that uses video to look at an athlete on a video call and analyze emotional expression, mm-hmm. then if you trained that on a data set of Finnish people, then the change in facial expression, I'm being a bit tongue in cheek, but the change in facial expression between super happy and not happy is almost non-existent. Whereas if you do it an American, it's wildly different. So, yes. It's the reason why, last year, the state of New York banned the use of any AI in recruitment protocols, because their argument was, legislatively, that if you're using this, it's been trained on a data set, and that data set can get inherently biased. So there's no, it's almost impossible to generate an AI system that isn't biased in some ways. That's why you need a human involved. Yes. So that's the AI thing. I mean, I think we could have a lengthy discussion.
Oh, mate, I love it. You and I feel like we could geek out.
Yeah, there's a whole sorts of rabbit holes you could go down around it. But then if you talk about wearables, I go back to this thing about buy-in. One of the biggest discussions that I have, and I get lots of companies approaching me, all the companies, all the big hitters, like the Norwegians are using. I've spoken to all those companies, and I use some of those products. I don't use them all the time because I don't live with my athletes, mm-hmm. 2/3 of the year, 24/7. But I go back to this thing about buy-in. And I go back to that book. Does it, the men in the boat, does it make the boat go faster? So if you go to an athlete and you say, look, we have this technology, it's going to give us this novel insight. How do you feel about that? Mm-hmm. They might say, that's great. Rasmus Svenningsen, who I coach, he is a qualified physician. So anything that's physiology related, he's all ears. He's all perky, perky, excited. Yeah, let's play, let's see what it can tell us. Somebody else, completely not interested. 100%. So it doesn't matter how good that wearable is, mm-hmm. the athlete's not bought in. And people forget as well, I did a presentation at sort of Cutting Edge Performance in Ireland last year. And one of the things I touched on is that long distance triathlon athletes train more than any other athletes pretty much on the planet. And I'm talking at Olympic level. Olympic swimmers, when you add up the amount of hours at Olympic level that they're swimming and going to the gym, it's less than your average long distance triathlete trains. If you look at the amount of hours that a professional cyclist in the Grand Tours trains, pretty much most of the year, it's significantly less hours of biking and gym work than a long-distance triathlete. And if you look at a runner, it's way less.
Doesn't even compare.
So when you look at somebody that's training 28, 30, 32 hours a week, including strength and conditioning and maybe massage and therapy work, and you go, well, hang on a minute, you've got to do your grocery shopping, you've got to cook, you've got to do your laundry. And then you say, oh, we've got this device and you need to charge it every day. Then you need to put it on your bike or in your shoes. And then you need to sort of, pair it with your handheld device before you start your training. And I would say 50 to 60% of professional triathletes just have already tuned out of that conversation. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They're like, if it's more complicated than pulling on a pair of socks, I'm not interested.
And often the information I get back can be a negative influence. Like, I don't need to double down on the negative if I've had an average day, right?
Yeah. What's the most powerful piece of information? Mm-hmm. Turning to the athlete and saying, how did you feel? Yeah. Now, you know, they might sugarcoat some things, but generally speaking, my personal experience with the level of athletes that I work with is, you know, I've never had to turn around to an athlete and say, come on, you know, suck it up, buttercup. You know.
Well, if you're having to do that, you've got the wrong athletes, yeah, right? I mean, it's like...
They're all... So if an athlete turned around to me and says, you know what? I know what the philosophical intention was with that workout today, but I called an audible and I did a few less reps, or I dialed down the intensity because that felt like the right thing to do. I'm like, fantastic, McDonald's gold star. You did exactly what I expected of you. All of my athletes know that they have the autonomy to make informed decisions, and some of them may be less inclined to do that based on experience or confidence. And it's my job to empower them with the knowledge and the wherewithal to kind of make some of those decisions, so that eventually, notionally speaking, at some point, I'm redundant.
The reality is that
most pros, you know, they don't want to write their own training program, but notionally, I'm trying to get to a point where it's very much a sort of a discursive sort of dialectic debate around, should we do this or should we do that? You know, I had a discussion with Josh Amberger about swimming this morning, and I was chatting with Andrew Horsfall-Turner yesterday, who's another Uber swimmer. And we were talking about Daniel Whiffen and the guy that just broke Grant Hackett's record. And sometimes I just have these conversations with athletes and say, well, what do you think? And invariably what they tell me is extremely powerful. So, you know, when you ask me, you know, who's influenced me, and you sort of expect me to name lots of coaches, yeah, I can name some coaches, but actually I would say probably the most influential thing on how I reflect and go about my job is every single athlete that I've coached in 28 years.
Who else has said that, something similar to that? And it's true, though. It's like the feedback of working with these athletes. And what I love about what you've just said is you're empowering these athletes to take control of their lives, right? It's like the old Aki Hintsa phrase that I often refer to, you know, he was up in Finland your way, and I did his training courses and things. And, you know, he said, do you know who you are? Do you know what you want? And are you in control of your own life? And it's like this... You're being a guide as much as a coach. Like you're guiding them to take more and more control over their emotions, over their mental performance, over their physical training, and that you're helping them mature into becoming great athletes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I could give you two examples of if you asked me, you know, what's been a high in my career, and it wouldn't be the answer you'd expect. You know, I had one age group athlete that I work with at one point, and he was a good age grouper. And one day it was about, you know, kind of just about the 17th of the month. And I get this really random payment of like $123 in my PayPal account. And I'm kind of like, well, that's not my coaching fee for sure. And I'm like, that's really strange. So I call him up and I say, hey, you know, I got this payment from you, and what's it for? And he said, my boss at work has done my quarterly review and basically told me that in the last few months that I have evolved as a person. And from my point of view, that's down to your influence on me. And so that's 10% of my bonus.
Wow.
And I went, huh.
That is cool.
And that to me is more satisfactory than, you know, a particular win. You know, I had in a similar vein, I had a lady I coached who was super, super talented professional, but just struggled with, you know, anxiety in races. And I did everything that I could. And, you know, we spoke to sports psychologists and all of that. And I said to them, you know what? I think the best thing that you could do is sit down with, you know, like a clinical psychologist. And they said, yeah, okay, you know, I'm open to that. And they did that. And a couple of weeks later, they came back and they said, you know what? I'm quitting the sport. And I said, you know, why is that? And they said, because I realize I'm doing it for all of the wrong reasons. And I said, I'm super happy for you.
Yes.
And they went away and, you know, they do something different now and they're happy. So,
isn't that the best? I mean, it's like I said earlier, when I was doing a little bit of coaching there for a while and I had a number of people ask if I was coaching. And I said, well, why do you want to do this? And if their why wasn't big enough, if they didn't have something, because the sport can be brutal. You know, it's tough. It's not physically, mentally, emotionally. It's very draining, like you said. Athletes train more than any other athlete in the world. You're tired. And you're going to spend a lot of time in that kind of a space. You know, everybody sees your occasional wins. And it's like, but you spend the rest of the time suffering. And it's like, well, I need to know why you want to do this. And it makes them pause for a second because quite often they just, you know, the whys can be quite shallow from being, I don't want to be the next Jan Frodeno. Well, it's like, well, that's not good enough.
Yeah. I mean, in psychology, what they talk about is like the six whys.
Mm-hmm, yes.
So if you ask somebody that question, you say, well, why?
Yeah.
They give you an answer. And then you say, well, why?
Yeah.
And then they give you an answer. And you go, and by the time you get six whys down, you're at core values.
Yes. Yes, so, that's some Japanese thing, isn't it?
Possibly. I don't know. I
just, something about that. I one of the books I've read along the way. But, you know, I love that. And it's, what's the other one? I heard it can also be three whys when if you ask somebody, you know, why are you doing it? Hmm. And the first answer they'll give you is, you know, what they think you want to hear. The second time you say why, it's the answer that they think they want to hear. And then the third why is the truth.
Yeah.
deeper and deeper.
And the irony is when you've been coached a long time, and I was guilty of this for many years, I thought, oh, you know, the best athletes in the world are intrinsically motivated. You know, extrinsic motivation is a bad thing. And then over the years, I realized it's not as reductionist as that. It's not 100%. As black and white as that. And likewise, people's motivations can be, it can be negative, you know, they can mm-hmm. be faith-based. They can be, I don't want to be, I'm not saying anything I shouldn't. I don't want to be seen as a recovering drug addict. You know, they can be all sorts of negative and positive drivers. And they're all good.
Mm-hmm.
You just sort of need to understand how to unpack them.
Yes. That's well put, mate. It's funny. I just read, have you read Andre Agassi's book, Open?
No.
It's a good book. He's very open. but throughout the book, he talks about how much he hates tennis.
Yeah.
Right? And he was made to do it and blah, 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 blah. And, but along the way, he sort of reinvented himself and blah, blah, blah. And I started asking myself the question, going, well, to be honest, I never liked swimming, biking or running. And yet I was a professional athlete for 27 years.
Yeah.
But I never liked swimming, biking and running, but I loved pushing myself. Like I loved being down in a dark room and the suffering. And I don't know why, really. Like it's like it's self-punishment, but it was. And then I loved the pats on the back. Like actually this whole extrinsic thing, like you said, it's like, yeah, I had a very powerful intrinsic force that wanted me to enjoy the suffering and taking myself to the edge and peering over that edge. But then extrinsically, I loved being known as a triathlete when I was a teenager. It made me feel like, okay, I had a little bit of identity. That was me. I was too small to be a rower or rugby player. So I found my way out of those very difficult adolescent years. And then through my 20s, it was giving me a sense of purpose every single year. It was like, okay, do better, be better. And all of a sudden, you know, fast forward the clock, you've been doing it for a long, long time and got some pats along the back. But to your point, yeah, it's not just intrinsically motivated. Like there can be bits and pieces.
I think as coaches, you know, we have a responsibility to help people walk away from us a better human being, you know, not just a better athlete, but a better human being. And so, you know, some of the things that you touched on there, the more I can help an athlete understand themselves in order to better themselves, the less likely they are to become one of those statistics that relates to the fact that 99% of professional athletes across professional sports do not get to retire on their own terms. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. foisted upon them either through injury or, you know, the level of sport moving on, or, you know, lack mm-hmm. of employment, or and so, yeah, when people are going to encounter that, if you haven't prepared them to understand themselves, then I think you're doing them a disservice.
Right, that is fantastic. Very wise words. I love that. And I was one of the 1% that got to actually, you know, I'd call it my Forrest Gump moment, yeah. you know, when he was running across America and he's like, I think I'm done now. And I had that at the Beijing Triathlon where I was sort of, I'd ridden up to the pack, which I included Alistair Brownlee. It was in 2016. So he's mm-hmm. just off the back of winning the gold. And it's like, okay, well, if I'm going to win this race, I've got to go now and I need to get a minute and a half off the bike and blah, blah, blah. And I'm doing all the math, you know, and all the calculations and what do I need to do? And then I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to do this. And I rode straight to the hotel, called the race director and said, mate, I've pulled out, called Laura. She'd raced that morning and said, I'm retired too. So we both retired at the same time. So I was very fortunate. But I think it was because I'd spent so much time in the sport that I actually did know who I was, what I wanted, and I didn't want to do it anymore. But mate, this has been fantastic. I could go on for hours with you. I think we could, I think this is going to have to be the first of many if you're up for it, because I do love this sort of a conversation. But I want to finish up before we do with what I ask all my guests and the final four questions. So the first one, if you could go back in time, what advice would you give your 18-year-old self?
Read more, learn more languages, travel more, and race bikes in the velodrome. I think I was built for racing in the velodrome. I'm like a running back with a set of lungs. And I think if I'd taken up doing sprinting in the velodrome, I would have had an absolute wild time.
And you were right around that, you know, when the British started to really own the velodrome too. I love that. Very cool. Actually, you know, sorry to bring it back to myself one more time, but I in 93 or 94, they tested a whole bunch of Australians mm-hmm. for what sports we should do. And number one sport for me was field hockey, which I had no interest in. But the other one was the velodrome. They wanted me to be on the pursuit team.
Yeah.
And they wanted me to go down to Adelaide. And out of that pursuit program came McGee, O'Grady, and McEwen, and what's the other one? They're all the same group.
Yeah.
So I was like, that could have been an interesting journey had I taken it, but I love triathlon. I'd already found the sport of triathlon. I wasn't interested. So, all right, mate, if you could have dinner with three people, they can be dead or alive, who would that be and why?
God, I mean, that's a tough one.
No, it changes every day.
I think if you, you know, if I don't be cliched and I don't pick a coach, you know, because then I think I'd probably want to sit down with Jiro Ono, who is in his 90s, is considered the greatest sushi chef of all time. If you've seen the documentary, Jiro Does Sushi. Mm. And I'd want to listen to him explain to me his obsession with perfectionism over decades in something which looks so simple. Probably the second person would be Dame Stephanie Shirley, who is again sort of late 80s, almost 90. She founded a software company in the 60s. I did say that correctly, the 60s, that employed mostly women, almost exclusively women who worked from home in the UK, and on things like the black box recorder for the Concorde. And she's now, you know, she made millions, and then she basically gave all that money to the employees and made about 70 of the employees millionaires overnight when she went public. She's a philanthropist. She's just an incredible human being. And I just want, again, to listen to her talk about getting the best out of people and navigating the world, because she came over as a child on the kinder bus from as an orphan and was to the UK. So just a fascinating, fascinating woman.
I'm going to look her up as soon as I'm done. We're done here, mate. Oh, that's fantastic.
And
yeah.
I guess the third person, because I am a bit analytical, would be a chap called Benoit Mandelbrot, who passed away a few years ago, who is a mathematician. He's considered the father of fractal geometry. And again, I'd want to have a conversation with him about just how he looked at the world and what made him just figure the things out about biology and nature and economics and politics in the way that he did.
How do I spell his name?
Mandelbrot, Mandelbrot.
Gotcha.
Those are probably not your normal answers, but...
That are fantastic. Are you kidding me? I love that. You know, that I think...
I mean, if I had to throw a coach in there, of course, there's only one person, and that's John Wooden. So
John Wooden. I think that... Mate, I want to be at that dinner table just to learn about these people. I think that's fantastic.
Like I said earlier on, I have a fascination with sort of complicated things and just a curiosity about how things work. And I think some, you know, great people that would be fascinating to talk to are people that have invented, you know, watch complications. I have a penchant for very nice mechanical watches. And, you know, there's individuals that they literally designed really, really complicated pieces of microscopic machinery from scratch. And some of them even like made the machines to make the parts. And you just kind of process that in your head and you go, how the heck did you reason that all through? And in a similar vein, one of my favorite things to watch, I haven't done any more seasons of it in a few years, but is Chef's Table on Netflix. And just to watch individuals that are world class.
Yeah.
And just look at and listen to their insatiable appetite for curiosity and knowledge and intricacy and in something which is so subjective. You know, humans are complex dynamic machines. You know, you can't reduce us to basic physiological principles. And so when you watch a program like that and you listen to these people talk about what they do with food and it, you know, how food tastes and is so subjective. And so that, you know, that's just such a huge fascination. And I think the kind of building on that, just reminded me, I was listening to Alain de Botton the other day and he mentioned that the field of psychology, you know, the understanding of the human mind is only really barely 100 years old. And he said, in the context of like medicine, we're still at the like sticking leeches on our body to solve problems in terms of our understanding of the human mind. So when people talk about coaching and technology and devices, I'm like, just take a step back for a minute. You're dealing with a human being. Now, we don't even really understand completely, you know, emotion, motivation, belief.
Isn't that awesome?
And if my job is to be, you know, a behavior change engineer, for want of a better phrase, then what does knowing this lactate value or that O2 uptake value really do to help me change behavior in this human being?
I love that. Behavior change engineer. That's really cool. I'm just written that down. Look, I it's music to my ears. I'm constantly saying to Laura and others that will listen to me, but it's like, I'm so excited about the potential that we still have in mental performance and understanding the cognitive clarity that people can potentially still have even when exhausted that we haven't tapped into yet.
Yeah.
And the triggers that could represent that. I've said for a long time, I feel physically we're doing pretty good in terms of human body and finding little bits more. But man, understanding emotions and how emotions affect hormones, how hormones then affect the physicality, how mentally, if you can tap into emotions the other way around, if you can trigger heightened emotions as you're running back home along the Queen K exhausted, to then interfere with the pathways of tiredness and create a stimulus that actually makes you feel greater. I don't know. There's so much still there that I'm...
We could talk a long time, yeah.
Well, mate, I know
so
you've got...
You said four questions, so...
We've got two more.
Two more, go on.
Okay, couple of quick ones. Where do you see yourself in, the next 5 years from now? Still coaching or...?
Doing the same thing. Hopefully with older kids that are able to critically think and love the outdoors.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Yep, being a dad. All right, this one's not meant to sound morbid, more just mm-hmm. to see what your interests are about. But if you only had 6 months to live, how would you want to spend those remaining 6 months?
Longer term financial implications aside, obviously because I'm going to die in 6 months, I would work as little as possible. And I would travel the world as much as possible with my kids and expose them to as many cultures and as many experiences and in as many environments to kind of grow them emotionally and intellectually as possible. And that probably means I'd visit quite a few of my athletes that I coach just because they're all just wonderful people living in...
Well, you need a place to stay. Places.
Well, not so much that. I don't think they want three young kids standing on their doorstep. It's interesting. I read an article a couple of years ago. It was a young entrepreneur in the US and he was worth, usual story, early 30s, worth millions.
Yeah.
And they said, what was sort of a seminal thing that, made you as good as you are? And he said, when he was a kid, every single holiday for as long as he could remember, and obviously his parents were maybe quite well off, but the principle is sound. Every holiday that they had, they traveled to a different place. In country, but they traveled to a different place every single holiday that they had. And so he said that what made him as successful was his ability to just understand different cultures, different, environments.
Yes. I love that.
That's what you need in this world. The world is a big place. And yet in this day and age of technology, a very small place.
Oh, it is. You know what it does is just to tap on it before we finish up here, but I was chatting to a mate the other day and, I went and raced for a team in Czech Republic in 93, 94, 95 with a good mate of mine, Jan Rahula, who was bronze medalist at the 2000 Olympics, but he organized it all for me. And so I'd gone through the 80s like you would have doing general studies where it was, the USSR was the evil empire and blah, 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 blah. And you weren't able to see individual people within any of this. And so to then go there and live in Czech for months at a time, I'm a 21, 22 year old kid and, they didn't speak English much at all, but getting around there and learning and just going, wow, people are people. And it was really cool when I asked, I don't know if it was Jan's parents or an older couple, and I said, they were both, working. I said, isn't it great that you're out of, this communism lockdown and dollar. And they said, well, no, we're really frightened. We don't know what we're going to do. We've never had it where we had free, we could do whatever I want. And I'd never heard that, right? I was coming from this, of course, it's going to be amazing. And I'm not advocating any political way of thinking, but it was just amazing that you'd been grained into you that of course, my way of life must be the most outstanding, and aren't they excited and lucky to have it? And they were like, well, actually, it makes us very scared. Mm. We've never had to be fend for ourselves and ask ourselves those questions. It's like, wow. So my point in saying in that is, yes, travel the world. Love that answer. Travel with your kids. Experience as much as you can. But
And I think, David, I think I'd finish and say, as a coach, find the time for reflection, because there's so much noise out there nowadays, information wise, and yet probably the most powerful tool that any coach can have is to just spend time reflecting on what they do, how they do it, why they do it. And if you can find time every day to do that, then that's great.
Mate, well said. And I think that's a great place to wrap this up, mate. But I really appreciate you coming on.
Not at all.
I think we're both aligned on many things. You're a deep thinker, and I really appreciate that. I know it's a late night for you. I know you've got to get up and look after the kids first thing in the morning, working on your dad bod. Mate, it's been really, really amazing.
My pleasure.
To have you on the show. And I hope this is the first of many conversations if you're up for it, because I think we got a lot to talk about.
Not a problem at all.
All right. And for everybody listening, you can find all the show notes, timestamps, and everything else at BennettEndurance.com/media. All right, it's down the line, mate. Cheers.